Hi, I'm Rob Grease and I'm the producer of Australian Rock of Ages, and it's a pleasure to bring you another program in this series of 24 monthly programs that will feature the life and time stories of some of the people whose talent, skills and dedication have contributed to the development of Australian music, particularly through the 1960s and 1970s. In this program, we feature the story of Sam C.
They asked me if I'd join to play keyboards and guitar, and I jumped at it. You know, I said, yeah, look, I think I saw the Flying Circus as being continuing my education, because the Sherbet, while we were getting good, you know, we were pretty tight, it was much more a pop-flavoured thing, and by that point, you know, as you say, you start to get these other influences coming in. And for me, it was the Byrds and the band, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Procol Harum in their pomp. And I just really wanted to pursue that and find how far I could go and how much I could learn. So I regrettably left Sherbet with my mother's words still ringing in my ears, "You're a fool, how can you know that band is going to be huge?"
That's right.
And I always knew they would be, because I think Daryl is one of the great singers that Australia's produced. But, you know, you're a young man and you've
got a dream and you want to follow it.
Yeah, and I didn't really, you know, money was not an issue. I was really just into becoming a better player.
Yes.
And so I gladly joined, and in the short term, at least, I probably was earning double what I'd earned in Sherbet, but it was, you know, two peanuts instead of one peanut, we're talking. And we started doing a lot of, you know, we did a lot of touring around Australia and so forth. So it was it wasn't glamorous, but it was certainly a level up. And they had also won the Battle of the Sounds. So as a result, it meant that joining them, I'd be going to the US to hopefully become an immense star.
So that was their prize, was it?
Yeah, yeah. Previously, it had been a trip to the UK. And whether maybe it still was, but the band, I think, never really wanted to go to the UK, and I can understand why, because they ended up there later.
Yeah, well, so many did, didn't they? Really, very little happened.
Well, nothing happened, you know. More of that later, if you could be bothered.
Yes.
But anyway, so there were articles in the rock trade, you know, has anyone got the right to give this punk a trip to the US that Red McKelvey earned? And I don't think Red could have cared less, but it was sort of a bit of a story.
Really?
And I have to say, it had no motivation whatsoever in my decision to join the band. I think the Flying Circus, you know, now I look back on it, were quite frightened of the whole notion of going, you know, we knew we weren't quite ready, and it was all a bit of a terrifying prospect, even though we thought we were men. We were just dumb kids. And I was probably the dumbest of the lot, you know. So there was an 11th hour meeting. The only album I did with the band in Australia over the course of a few weeks. And it wasn't a great album. It had a few good songs, one of which was Turn Away, which is a Doug Rowe song, which was totally ignored because the band had donned our R.M. Williams and we weren't a bubblegum band anymore, definitely. And so those who'd, you know, supported it, like Radio, just gave it a miss. But it still is a good song, and it was a pity that more people didn't hear it, really. So we were touring around and gathering money for our assault on the U.S., and accordingly we went.
Had you started writing your own material at that stage?
I had. They were pretty, you know, there's a few examples of it on that last Flying Circus album that were pretty juvenile, you know, and I can hear what I was trying to do. You know, it's a bit of a joke we have. You play something really good and somebody in the band will say, I can really dig what you were trying to do there.
Oh, God.
But it was, there were a few, like, there were germs of ideas that I had no idea of how to do it. The first song I had recorded was actually by Fraternity, which I wasn't in, which I co-wrote with their bass player, Bruce Howe. And if you hear it, it was just released on that country compilation that Warner's put out. And you listen to it and you go, oh my God, you know, it's sort of so influenced by the band, and it's a Civil War song and it's very juvenile.
But, I mean, that's, it's easy to make those judgments now, but if you go, if you try and put yourself back in that period of time, those influences on you were very strong
then. Oh, they certainly were.
So it's understandable. What about going to the States? Did that turn out to be a pleasurable experience for you?
Oh, it was life-changing. It really was.
In what way?
Well, I guess for a start, we, from day one, you know, we left on a P&O boat, which in those days was pretty snooty, and we left the harbour on a lovely day, I think it was February, and as soon as we got out of the heads, ran into this huge storm, and the boat was, even though it was state-of-the-art for the day, it was pitching and yawing and rocking.
Wow.
It's where I discovered I don't get seasick. For all my other weaknesses, I don't. That's not something I get. So the first night at dinner, I think Terry Wilkins, the bass player, and I were sitting at dinner with the other person that, who'd been assigned to our table, which was a retired, probably definitely gay public servant from Canberra who looked at us as if his, you know, his dream trip had been destroyed by being sat at our table. And, you know, he loathed us on sight. And so Terry and I were there. The rest of the guys were all, you know, had their heads over the side of the ship, as most of the ship did. And it was the first few days we're going, wow, this is going to be different, and it was. Then suddenly, you know, we hit New Zealand and the weather calmed down, had a magnificent trip over. We were exhausted from trying to get money, so we weren't required to play on the ship. But after about a week, we liked playing. Mm-hmm. So we started playing at 11 o'clock at night after the regular stiffs had finished their gig and people would be going to bed. We just sort of, I'd play a bit of piano and we had our acoustics and stuff. So we'd do these gigs, and one by one, like, it wasn't a gig.
It was an organised,
People would start coming up, particularly the girls, you know, so we disrupted the whole routine of the ship, which was, you know, nobody was showing up for the 10 o'clock shuffleboard
because
they'd been up late. And we were having a great old time. And so they sort of accommodated us. They banned us from doing the gigs every night, but they let us sort of have a few over the course of the ship. They, as I said, they weren't really organised gigs, but that was great fun. And then we met these people who were returning from New Zealand to Hawaii. And there were a couple of blokes who were draft dodgers. And I think they had been given, in the meantime, they'd been given dishonourable discharges and they were moving back to live in Hawaii. So this is sort of the backdrop, I suppose, to what we were discussing earlier about the whole reaction to the war. You know, I think Gough Whitlam was certainly starting to campaign. This was 71, and it was time for a change, as we all found out and knew. But these guys were interesting, apart from the fact they had one bloke had figured out this probably won't get on the interview, but he'd figured out a good way of getting a discharge, and he had you tattooed on his hand.
Oh, really? And that was enough?
So he couldn't salute. So when we got to Hawaii, they had this whole network of people on the north of Oahu, and that was one of the most enjoyable days of my life. They took us to this place that you can't go to anymore, I think, called Sacred Falls.
Right.
And it was a hollowed out extinct volcano, maybe it was the sill of a volcano, that had a fall, and you could dive off the fall into this beautiful lit deep pool. It was just a magnificent day and wonderful people. And I think, you know, Terry and I wrote a song about that day, which was probably one of the first good songs I wrote. And so that was profound. Then we finally arrived at San Francisco, which was where we were supposed to make a beachhead to launch our attack on the American music scene. And we arrived, our manager had rented an apartment for us in Haight-Ashbury, and we got off the ship, and I for some reason, I don't know why, well, actually I do, I'd had my 21st birthday, so somebody, you know, I'd accumulated a few dollars, very few, and so I was made the treasurer of the band, which was a mistake, because I'm not very good with money, but I remember I had the address, this apartment, so we had two cabs, because we had guitars and all that stuff. We hopped in the cab, and my cab driver wouldn't believe me that that was it. You got off the P&O and you want to go to this address? I don't think so. And I said, no, that's the address. So we got to Downey Street, 204 Downey Street. And it was incredible. Like, the cabs pulled up, people started coming out of their houses to see, like, A, who's getting a cab, you know, because no one had money for cabs. But it was this, you know, just greeting by people from all over America, but not San Franciscans. They were all people from Kansas or Maine, or because in those days everybody went to look for America in San Francisco, even though the summer of love had long passed, you know.
Yes.
And Rob, it was an unbelievable period. Like, we were only there for 3 months, I guess. We had planned to live there. We were austrophobes. We hated the government. We hated Vietnam. We thought we could just move over to America and make music and make a living. But we couldn't, because the immigration department said, yeah, you guys, welcome to America. You can work here if the musicians union will give you the okay. The musicians union said, boys, welcome to America, and you're welcome to do gigs here if the immigration department agrees. So it was the old catch 22. But in the meantime, we went to all these shows at the Fillmore, like, just soaked up the whole ambience, you know, and I remember everything so vividly. Not everything, I have vivid memories of the days there, because, you know, it was the first experience that I suppose any of us had of a more cosmopolitan, outward-looking world. And I wouldn't normally say that about the US, because it's so insular, but in San Francisco, we joined up to the commune, you know, and there's duly these boxes of organic vegetables, some of them not rotten, would arrive. And dope was abundant. The music was just every, like, the Fillmore had these acts on every night, like Aretha, like Fleetwood Mac. Who else? We saw Fleetwood Mac's last show with Jeremy Spencer before he joined the Children of God. Who else did we? We saw heaps of people. Yeah. I can't remember offhand, but it was a stunning awakening for all of us, you know, and I think it was also bloody frightening, because we realised we had a long way to go to get to the level of the acts that we wanted to compete with or emulate, you know. So it was a wonderful time, you know, and I remember the colours, and I don't mean the acid colours, I just mean the colours and the smells and the whole thing.
Did it turn out to be a situation of taking coals to Newcastle?
I don't think we had our identity sorted out to that point yet. You know, like we were a country rock band, but I don't think we didn't quite have our own sound sorted out. So it probably might have been, I guess, you know, because there were bands doing it better and earlier than we did.
Because a lot of Australian groups that went over found that, didn't they? They were, like Danny Cool, you know, they found they were trying to import the native music back.
Sure, sure. Well, I think, I mean, Daddy Cool had a couple of people. I think they were, you know, I've seen this time and time again in the business that you really, and it happened to Flying Circus later on, there were capital, Flying Circus without me, but because I left and rejoined, but they were the first Australian band to be signed to an American record deal, like as an American act. And the guys who were sort of really supporting them, and they got, you know, they had Hit Pick on Cashbox and Billboard. Everything was going sweet. Suddenly those guys who were pushing the Flying Circus button were working for other record companies because they had this revolving door thing, and the new guys didn't want us, so it was all over. And I've seen that happen to lots of people, like Mondo Rock, I know it happened to. Daddy Cool, I don't know the history of, but it's just one of those, you know, it's fate. You know, somebody... I know, for example, LIB, who were hugely successful, nearly weren't. It was just, oh, God, Florida picked them up. And suddenly, they were a very good live act, you know, but it wouldn't have mattered if that hadn't, one little thing hadn't happened.
Yes.
And it's just so often the case.
Yeah.
So anyway, I mean, Flying Circus, we were running out of money. We'd run out of money. We were living on scrambled eggs and didn't have many of those left. And our manager, by virtue of a tour that we'd done with a Canadian band called McKenna Mendelssohn Mainline, had hooked up in Toronto with their management and got us a tour for, I'm not sure, 3 months in Canada. So we ended up getting on the Greyhound bus, every time I see that Greyhound bus, from San Francisco to Vancouver. We went through Oregon. So that was it for San Francisco. We left, caught the train across Canada, did a 3 month stint, which was full of highlights that I remember many of, and then had to come back to Australia. In the meantime, I'd been asked to join Fraternity because their keyboard player was leaving, and Fraternity were probably my musical mentors when I'd been living in Australia. So I reluctantly left the Flying Circus, and they had also won the Battle of the Sounds. They won it the first day we got back to Melbourne. So they had a free trip, and it was starting to build into this pattern.
Yes.
but anyway, so I joined Fraternity, and it was sort of, I realised almost as soon as I'd done it that it was a mistake, even though they'd moved to Adelaide and we were living up in the hills in Adelaide, which was beautiful, but it wasn't a happy band. They'd stopped writing the music that I'd joined them to play, and they'd sort of become a band, cover band in some respects. Bon Scott was the singer of that band. We went to England, and the less I say about England, the better, because it was ghastly. It was the worst year, I think, of my young life. It was poor. It was uninspiring, and we did two tours of Germany, at which I had a great time because I spoke German from school a bit and got myself into all kinds of trouble in Germany. But when we were in England, it was a miserable time, and the band just stopped writing. You know, I was the only one who was writing songs, and the other guys, like Mick Jerd, who was the guitar player of Fraternity, was one of my great idols and influences. Everyone was so broken down at heel that I think we'd lost the spark. So Flying Circus called me back and asked me to rejoin. And I jumped at the chance. By that point, they'd emigrated to Canada. And they were sort of on the verge of something great, but which didn't transpire. And they were my friends. You know, I love the boys in Flying Circus. They were terrific fellas.
Now, you said the experience in Canada was great. Was that also when you met your current partner?
After Flying Circus, I then joined this Canadian rock orchestra called Lighthouse that I'm praising this now. Quick. Yeah, after Flying Circus lost our record deal, the band split, and I joined a very popular Canadian rock orchestra called Lighthouse, and we toured all through the States. But unfortunately, that came to the end, and I was just drifting around doing odd jobs for a little while, and then I heard that there was this band in a town called Hamilton, which is near Toronto. It's kind of the Geelong of Toronto, needed a guitar player. So I went down to look at them, and there she was, my gorgeous wife now.
Judy.
Yeah, Judy. So she was one of the singers in the band. She was playing a bit of piano. She would say not well. And so I joined on spec, and only joined for a little while because that band wasn't going anywhere particularly. But Judy and I have made a connection.
It was a pretty quick connection, was it?
It was, yeah. It was sort of over a week, I guess. Right. You know?
Yep.
And I had another partner at the time, so nothing eventuated then. But as you know, later on in life, I got back in touch with her, and here we are. You know, we've been married for 10 years, and one of the luckiest things I ever did.
Mm. So how did you get from Canada back to Australia? I mean, was that a working story, or did you just have enough?
No, that's a working story. After that, I was doing, once again, just doing odd jobs, a bit of driving, and a bloke called Greg Quill came over to Canada, and I sherbeted back Greg on his first ever gig way back in 69. And I just sort of saw him. I knew Tony, the drummer who'd played with The Affair with Kerry Bedell. And so Greg and I got to know each other. I wasn't playing with him originally. I think I might have been doing something else. But we ended up hooking up together, and we made some really good music for about a year and a half to no response from the record companies in Canada. And somebody offered Greg a tour back in Australia.
This program is a Handsome Doc production and is podcast through the Toorak Times and TAG.